Last week we started looking at the stories in the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel we saw was written during the time that the Israelites were in exile in Babylon. And we looked at the stories in the first three chapters of Daniel. And today we're going to continue on and look at the rest of the stories in the book, which you especially see in chapters 4 through 6. Chapters 7 through 12 deal with some visions, and we'll touch on those briefly, but we'll especially look at the stories that we have in chapters 4 through 6. Now, in our lesson last week, we looked at the stories in chapters 1 through 3, and a key person in those lessons was a guy named Nebuchadnezzar. So let's remind ourselves a little bit about who he was and what was his relationship with the Jews back then. If you turn to Jeremiah chapter 39, it starts out, this is how Jerusalem was taken. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army and laid siege to it. So there we see Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar was a king of Babylon, we see there. And here we see his first interaction here, or his interaction with the Jews, is not a real positive one, at least on the Jews' perspective. Going on to verse 4, the story picks up. It says, when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and all the soldiers saw the Babylonians, they fled. They left the city at night by way of the king's garden through the gate between the two walls and headed towards the Araba. That's over towards the Jordan River to get away as far as they could. But the Babylonian army pursued them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. They captured him and took him to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, at Riblah in the land of Hamath, which is where he was, and where he pronounced sentence on Zedekiah. There at Riblah, the king of Babylon, that is Nebuchadnezzar, slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes and also killed the nobles of Judah. Then he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with bronze shackles to take him to Babylon. Then the Babylonians set fire to the royal palace and the houses of the people and broke down the walls of Jerusalem. Nebuzaradan, the commander of the imperial guard, carried into exile to Babylon the people who remained in the city, along with those who had gone over to him, and the rest of the people. So, who was Nebuchadnezzar? He was the king of Babylon. What was his relationship with the Jews? Not real good. He came and he attacked and destroyed. Didn't just attack Jerusalem, he totally destroyed Jerusalem. Destroyed the temple, destroyed the palace, tore them down, burned them to the ground, tore down the walls of Jerusalem, tore down the city itself, made Jerusalem cease to exist as a city, and took all the people and took them with him to Babylon. You see his treatment of the king Zedekiah, and that is the reputation that this guy got, was one of being one to be feared. So why did he do this? Why did he come and attack Jerusalem? Was it just on a whim or what? Turn back to Jeremiah 25, verse 4, and this is Jeremiah talking to the Israelites about what their problems were. And he says, though Yahweh has sent his servants the prophets to you again and again, you have not listened or paid attention. They said, turn now, each of you, from your evil ways and your evil practices, and you can stay in the land that Yahweh gave to you and your fathers forever and ever. Do not follow other gods to serve and worship them. Do not provoke me to anger with what your hands have made. Then I will not harm you. But you didn't listen to me, declares Yahweh, and you have provoked me with what your hands have made, and you have brought harm to yourselves. So you see that the judgment that we're about to hear is in response to what they did themselves. Okay, and they brought harm to themselves. Therefore, the Lord Almighty says this, because you have not listened to my words, I will summon all the peoples of the north and my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, declares the Lord. And I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants and against all the surrounding nations. I will completely destroy them and make them an object of horror and scorn and an everlasting ruin. So why did Nebuchadnezzar attack Jerusalem? Because God called him to. This was God's plan. Here we see that this pagan, vicious king Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, God calls him my servant. So Nebuchadnezzar, whether he realized it or not, which certainly he didn't, was doing God's work, was being God's servant when he came and attacked and brought the Jews into exile. And bringing God's judgment on the Jews for their unfaithfulness. Well, how did the Jews feel about this guy? Well, you can just imagine. Jeremiah 51 gives us just a little taste of that. Verse 34 and 35 says, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has devoured us. He has thrown us into confusion. He's made us an empty jar. Like a serpent, he swallowed us and filled his stomach with our delicacies, and then has spewed us out. May the violence that's been done to our flesh be done upon Babylon, say the inhabitants of Zion. May our blood be on those who live in Babylonia, says Jerusalem. So you can see they hated Nebuchadnezzar. They hated the Babylonians, and they wanted vengeance. And they prayed to God that God would bring vengeance. So that's the relationship that we see between these. So did they ever see the vengeance that they wanted? Well, Jeremiah kind of foretells that back in Jeremiah 25 again. If we just continue on kind of where we left off, it says in verse 12, but when the 70 years are fulfilled, I will punish the king of Babylon and his nation, the land of the Babylonians, for their guilt, declares the Lord, and I will make it desolate forever. I will bring upon that land all the things that I've spoken against it, all that are written in this book and prophesied by Jeremiah against all the nations. They themselves will be enslaved by many nations and great kings. I will repay them according to their deeds and the work of their hands. So the Jews were told, even before Nebuchadnezzar came in, even before all this happened, that they would get their vengeance, that God would punish them for the way that they're treating the Jews and for their evils. So that vengeance would occasionally come, eventually come. Okay, so the Jews are now in Babylon, in exile in Babylon. We saw in the story of Daniel last week that Daniel was part of the Jewish nobility, part of the wealthy, noble, intelligent people, not one of the peasants. How did he become subject to Nebuchadnezzar? We see that in the first verses of Daniel. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. So we see that before Zedekiah, during the reign of Jehoiakim, was when we first see the first exile. The Zedekiah exile is the last one that brought the rest of the people over. But in under Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Jerusalem and took all the valuable stuff and, as we saw, all the valuable people. So all the nobility and the officials and their families. And so that's where we see the nobility becoming subjects to Nebuchadnezzar and going into Babylon with this very first exile. Well, normally when a king conquers another nation, one of the first things he does is annihilate, get rid of, kill off the officials, the nobility of the nation that he's conquered, so that they cannot raise together an army and rise up and attack from within or be a threat. So did Nebuchadnezzar do that? Going on, verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. Ashpenaz was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. So he didn't kill off the nobility. Instead, he enlisted them in his service, and he took the young nobility, the ones that showed promise, and sent them through a college, sent them through a training session of 3 years where they learned the Babylonian language, the Babylonian ways, the ways that you make decisions, all of that. Had them trained for 3 years, and then they would be tested, and the cream of that crop would be then put into service, into the king's service as officials. Well, who were some of the cream of the cream? Well, going on, verse 6. Among these were some from Judah. So some of them were Jews. These were not only Jews that he did this with, but other peoples that he had conquered. These Jews included Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But those were Jewish names, so the chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. And we looked last week at what those names meant, and that those were names that were given after the names of the gods of the Babylonians. Verse 17, we see that to these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kind. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every manner of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. So we see that among the best were these four Jews, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They got names, Babylonian names, and they were very well blessed by God, and as a result were recognized as being cream of the crop, and were then put into service to Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? That's the stories that we had in chapter 1. Chapter 2, then, we see something happen that led Daniel and these guys to become even chief officials, not just service to Nebuchadnezzar, but high up. We'll kind of conclude that in chapter 2, verse 26. It says, "The king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, 'Are you able to interpret what I saw? Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?'" Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. We saw that last week. And he wanted to know what the dream meant. But not only that, but he wanted to make sure that the wise men who were explaining the dream to him also had the insight that they said they had. So he said, "You tell me what my dream was as well, not just what it means." So Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery that he's asked about. But there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay in your bed are these." And then we saw last week that he goes on to tell the dream and explain the dream. Verse 48, "As a result of that, the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all of its wise men." So you see that by God revealing Nebuchadnezzar's dream and its meaning through Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar was very impressed with the relationship that God had, that Daniel had with God, and we'll see that as we keep going. And so he named Daniel as a high official. By doing so, he's bringing Daniel's God into his government. So what was this dream? Well, we looked at the dream itself last week. What was the purpose of the dream? Verse 47. "The king said to Daniel, 'Surely your God is God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of this mystery, a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery.'" And that was the purpose of the dream. The dream, sure, it told Nebuchadnezzar of things that were to come. But most of the things that were to come were things that were going to happen after Nebuchadnezzar was gone. Okay? Instead, what this showed is that only God could reveal to Daniel what Nebuchadnezzar's dream was and what it meant, and Nebuchadnezzar recognized that, and Nebuchadnezzar therefore recognized that the God of Daniel was God, was a God. Okay? He came to that realization. "Surely your God is God of gods and the Lord of kings." So it began Nebuchadnezzar's faith in Yahweh, faith in God. And by Nebuchadnezzar recognizing that and stating that in public, that begins to spread and spreads God's name through the world, so that the name of Yahweh is being passed around throughout the greatest kingdom of the world at the time, Babylon. then we have this story in chapter 3 of Daniel's friends, of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, otherwise known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and that they stood up for their faith and would not listen, would not bow down to this statue that Nebuchadnezzar had made to his god Nebu, and as a result were thrown into the fiery furnace, but God protected them. And Nebuchadnezzar saw that, and so you see that was impacting Nebuchadnezzar's faith as well. And the result of that, chapter 3, verse 28, it says, as a result, Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than to serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way. So you see his reaction. You see that he recognizes that Yahweh is God. And he does his normal thing of overreacting with a decree. It says nobody can speak bad about against their God because he is God. Okay? So we've seen that Nebuchadnezzar has been introduced to Yahweh, and his recognition of Yahweh as God has been reinforced by the stories that we saw last week. Well, it gets even stronger this week. It goes on. Okay, we saw a dream last week. We see another dream in chapter 4. And we'll start there. Chapter 4, verse 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. I had a dream that made me afraid. As I was lying in my bed, the images and visions that passed through my mind terrified me. So you see, he had another dream. And what was going on? Were there major wars or the like that caused him to have a bad dream that bothered him and wouldn't allow him to sleep? No, it says that I was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. Everything was going well. Okay? Nothing was going on. Well, as you might imagine, in the book of Daniel, Daniel gets involved again. We see that in the next verses. And this is Nebuchadnezzar talking. He gives this story here. So, I commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be brought before me to interpret the dream for me. When the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners came, I told them the dream, but they couldn't interpret it for me. Finally, Daniel came into my presence, and I told him the dream. By the way, he's called Belteshazzar after the name of my God, and the spirit of the holy gods is in him. I've seen that. Okay? So I said, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and no mystery is too difficult for you. Here's my dream. Interpret it for me. So, again, we see, like before, the wise men could not interpret the dream. Now, this time, he's telling them the dream, but they couldn't understand it. They could not give an interpretation. So, Nebuchadnezzar tells Daniel, who he knows could answer. And so, what was the dream going on? These are the visions I saw while lying in my bed. I looked, and there before me stood a tree in the middle of the land. Its height was enormous. The tree grew large and strong, and its top touched the sky. It was visible to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, and on it was food for all. Under it, the beasts of the fields found shelter, and the birds of the air lived in its branches. From it, every creature was fed. In the visions I saw while lying in my bed, I looked, and there before me was a messenger, a holy one, coming down from heaven. He called in a loud voice, cut down the tree and trim off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But let the stump and its roots, bound with iron and bronze, remain in the ground, in the grass of the field. So, again, dreams are weird. So this is a weird dream. You've got this huge tree that's covering the earth with shelter for all animals and people, birds, okay? And then an angel comes from heaven and commands it to be cut down and ripped apart, okay? But he says, leave a stump there. Now, as dreams go, they often take weird turns, and this takes a weird turn. Going on, it says, let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. You see, it changes from talking about a tree to now it says, let him. So it's like it's talking about a man, and you'll see that as we keep going here. It says, let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him live with the animals among the plants of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let him be given the mind of an animal till seven times pass for him. Okay? So this tree stump changed into a man here, okay? It's talking about a tree stump, and then it starts talking to it about a man. So apparently that tree stump, it represents something about this man. And it says, let his mind be changed from that of a man to the mind of an animal. Okay, so he'd go nuts. He would have a mind of an animal for seven times. Now that times could be a year, so it could be 7 years, or it's also could be seven seasons, you know, like winter, summer, spring, fall. So it could be like 3 3/4 years. So it could be one of the others it's referred to there. Now the angel wrapped it up then by pointing out that this really is an important thing. This dream has a special meaning here. Verse 17, it says, the angel says, this decision is announced by messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict so that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives to them anyone he wishes and sets over them the lowliest of men. So he was told, the angel showed that it was a decision from God, the Most High. And it was a decision that was there so that the living might know that God is sovereign, that God is God, that Yahweh is God. Okay? So that's the purpose of this dream. That's the purpose of this story, the purpose of what's going to happen here. So, Nebuchadnezzar then concludes, this is the dream that I, King Nebuchadnezzar, had. Now, Belteshazzar, tell me what it means, for none of the wise men of my kingdom can interpret it for me, but you can, because the spirit of the holy gods is in you. So, what's the meaning of the dream? Verse 19. Then Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, just so we don't forget, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him. So the king said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you. Belteshazzar announced, or answered, my lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. So Daniel knew what the dream meant. It wasn't good. It was not a good dream for Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to know what it meant. Daniel fought, trying to find a way, how can I say this without getting him too upset? Because it's not good. And his answer to Nebuchadnezzar said, don't worry about it. You tell me what it says. Don't be afraid of telling me. And Daniel goes, oh, if only this dream was about your enemies and not about you. So he positions it before he tells him the meaning. Well, so what was it? What was the tree? Verse 22. Daniel says, you, O king, are that tree. You've become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends to the distant parts of the earth. So that huge tree that could be seen from all over the earth, that was Nebuchadnezzar. He was ruling the earth. The whole earth knew him, and he covered the earth with his shade. Okay? So Nebuchadnezzar and his greatness was that tree. Now there's another nation that we see back in Hosea that's referred to as an expansive tree. Look at Hosea chapter 14. Verse 1 says, return, O Israel, to Yahweh your God. Your sins have been your downfall. And then going on, verse 5, I will be like the dew to Israel. He will blossom like a lily. Like a cedar of Lebanon, he will send down his roots. His young shoots will grow. His splendor will be like that of an olive tree. His fragrance, like the cedar of Lebanon. Men will dwell again in his shade. He will flourish like the grain. He will blossom like a vine. And his fame will be like the wine from Lebanon. So Israel is equated to a large tree that God cares for and that people find rescue in its shade. That is, if Israel repents and turns back to God, Hosea calls. So, Nebuchadnezzar is this great tree. Well, what about the whole thing of the tree getting chopped down and the mind of an animal and all of that going on? I'll start at verse 24. Daniel goes on, "This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree that the Most High has issued against my lord the king. You will be driven away from people, and you will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle, and you will be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men, and he gives them to anyone he wishes." So the story about the stump turning into a man that turns into the mind of an animal is telling what's going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar, that basically he's going to go crazy for seven times, whether 7 years or 3 3/4 years. He's going to be crazy, live like an animal, until he acknowledges that Yahweh is king, that Yahweh is God, that Yahweh is in control of everything, including in control of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? So we've seen that Nebuchadnezzar has been introduced to Yahweh. We saw through the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that his faith was built upon. And now God wants him, the greatest king, the most powerful king that this world has probably seen, we talked about last week, recognizes and acknowledges and believes that Yahweh is sovereign over all. Nebuchadnezzar is not sovereign over all. Well, it also talks about this tree stump. Verse 26, Daniel says, "The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules." So Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom would be restored to him when he did turn to Yahweh. Okay? Now, God has said this is what's going to happen. Was there anything that Nebuchadnezzar could do to keep that from happening? Going on, verse 27. Daniel says, "Therefore, O king, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be then that your prosperity will continue." So Daniel says, "King, you can maybe stop this if you turn from your evil ways, if you let God be sovereign over you rather than you being sovereign over everything. Okay, renounce your sins, be righteous, be faithful, and that could stop this from happening." So, did he? Going on. All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of his royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon that I've built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" The words were still on his lips when a voice came from heaven. "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken away from you. You will be driven away from the people, and you will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle. Seven times will pass by you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes." Immediately, what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and the nails like the claws of a bird. So you see, it took a year, but a year later, in a moment of great pride of himself, looking at his own magnificence rather than the glory of God, he takes credit for everything that had been built. He takes credit for Babylon and the kingdom and the greatness. Though it was God that built that for him, God that called Nebuchadnezzar his servant, Nebuchadnezzar instead says, "Look at what I've done. Look at this greatness of me. Look at the glory of me that has been a glory of my majesty here." And immediately, the angel comes, says, "Now it's going to happen," and immediately he goes crazy, just as his dream had foretold. So, it foretold that seven times would pass, and then eventually Nebuchadnezzar would recognize that Yahweh is God, and then he would be restored. So did that happen? Going on. And again, this is Nebuchadnezzar telling the story. Verse 34. "At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. And then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified Him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as He pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back His hand or say to Him, "What have you done?" At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. So yes, it happened just as was foretold by the dream, just as interpreted by Daniel, just as stated by the angel. After that seven times, he regained his sanity. He praised God. He recognized God as Yahweh. And you see, this is Nebuchadnezzar writing. The great pagan king of Babylon recognizes and confesses that Yahweh is God. And then he's restored to his kingdom just as was foretold. Did this dream and fulfillment have its desired effect on turning Nebuchadnezzar to Yahweh? Going on, verse 37. Now, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything He does is right, and all His ways are just. And those who walk in pride, He's able to humble. So yes, you see, Nebuchadnezzar came to believe and have faith in God. He was turned to God. He praised God. How sincere and enthusiastic was Nebuchadnezzar's praise for God? Well, let's go to the very first verses of this chapter. And again, this is King Nebuchadnezzar writing this. King Nebuchadnezzar, to the peoples, nations, and men of every language who live in all the world, may you prosper greatly. It is my pleasure to tell you about the miraculous signs and wonders that the Most High God has performed for me. How great are His signs, how mighty His wonders. His kingdom is an eternal kingdom. His dominion endures from generation to generation. So you see that this whole chapter, Nebuchadnezzar wrote, this was not written by Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar wrote this, and he wrote this as a proclamation to his people to let them know that Yahweh is sovereign, that God is king of all. And he tells the story so that they'll see that and recognize that. He documents the story in praise in a letter to all the world, to people of all nations. Okay? So there we see that the stories that we have in Daniel to this point take the most pagan leader of the most pagan nation, the great nation of Babylon, and bring him to faith in Yahweh, faith in God. Okay? Well, that's the story of Nebuchadnezzar. We move on to chapter 5, and we see a new king. Now, if you remember, we looked at the kings in last week. Nebuchadnezzar was followed by his son Evil-Merodach, and then there were a couple other kings. All three of those kings that followed Nebuchadnezzar had pretty short reigns. And then there was a guy named Nabonidus who took over in a coup. After he ruled for a little while, he then retired and left his son Belshazzar in charge. Okay, not Belteshazzar, but Belshazzar. Belshazzar means Bel, protect the king. Okay, Bel again was the great god of the Babylonians, also known as Marduk, the chief god. Okay, and so now in chapter 5, we jump ahead, and now Belshazzar is king. So, Nebuchadnezzar had become faithful to God, or had found faith in God. Did Belshazzar continue in that faithfulness? Going on. Chapter 5, verse 1. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and the silver goblets to Nebuchadnezzar, his father. Now, when you see the word father here, obviously Belshazzar's father was Nabonidus, who was not a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar. This father, when you'll see it in this chapter, refers to his predecessor. Okay, he was the great king, and he was recognized as being the father of the kings of Babylon. You'll also see Belshazzar being referred to as Nebuchadnezzar's son, but again, that's his successor. So, So Belshazzar was drinking wine and had this great party, and he gave orders to bring out the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem. Okay, these were the devoted articles of the temple, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, of iron, of wood, of stone. So they drank toasts. They took these devoted temple articles, these goblets, and they drank them in this party and toasted all these man-made gods, all these made-up gods. They probably made up a few while they were toasting here. Okay? So it was this big party here. Now, they were drinking and drinking and drinking, but something happened to suddenly sober them up. We see in verse 5. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. So while they were drinking and partying, he looked up and he saw not a person, but just the fingers of a hand writing on the wall. And you had this hand writing on the wall, and it was there. And he was scared to death. He turned pale, his knees knocked. There you see a biblical note of the knees knocking here. And he was scared. He didn't know what this was and what this meant. Well, how does he figure out what it all means? Well, verse 7, the king called out for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought and said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made third highest in the kingdom. So why third highest? Well, you've got Nabonidus, his father, and Belshazzar, and those are the first and second, and so the third would be this person. So he would be next in command, right? So he offers this fame and fortune to whoever can interpret this. Well, then all the king's wise men came in, and they could not even read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. This obviously means something. The queen, or the queen mother, hearing the voices of the king and the nobles, came into the banquet hall. O king, live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has a spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man, Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. So call for Daniel, and he will tell you what this writing means. So, again, the wise men, we've seen this before in this book, were not able to give an interpretation, but the queen mother remembered Daniel and said, call for him. He's got the spirit of the gods in him, and the gods will interpret it through him. So, he calls for Daniel, and how does Belshazzar try to influence an interpretation, and how does Daniel respond? Verse 16. Now, Belshazzar says to Belteshazzar, or to Daniel, I've heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you'll be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you'll be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered the king, you can keep the gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. But nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king, and I'll tell him what it means. So again, he offered this riches and power and honor, but Daniel said, no, I'm not working for you, I'm working for God, I'm working for Yahweh. I'll tell you what it means, you don't need to give me anything for it. So I will tell you what it means. Now, Daniel recalls back and refers back to the story in chapter 4, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and how God came and revealed himself to Nebuchadnezzar, and uses that story to explain Belshazzar's problem here and what this situation is highlighting. Continuing on, verse 18. O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all peoples and nations and men of every nation and language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. And those he wanted to promote, he promoted. Those he wanted to humble, he humbled. So God, the great God, Yahweh, gave him that power. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes. So he was in control of Nebuchadnezzar being king, just as, by the way, he's in control of you being king, Belshazzar, right? Going on. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all of this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and your nobles, and your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all of your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. Now, Daniel was not there when they were partying. Daniel was not there when they brought in those goblets and drank wine from those goblets and praised all these different gods. But yet, he revealed that. He told that to the king, and he said, you have not recognized that Yahweh is sovereign, even though you knew the stories of Nebuchadnezzar. And so he sent this hand to write this inscription. Okay? You've desecrated God while Nebuchadnezzar turned to him. So this is what the inscription was. Okay, verse 25, it said, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson. Okay, so he was able to read the scribbling and read those words. Now those words have many different meanings. Okay, just by looking at the word Mene means numbered. Okay, but it's also like the word Mina, okay, which was a coin. Or a weight in those days. Okay, coins denoted weight, and so Mene is the same as Mina, which also means numbered. And we'll see that that's kind of the greatest value, and that has Nebuchadnezzar is what that represents. It represents the ruler Nebuchadnezzar. Then the word tekel sounds like shekel, and actually is shekel, which is another coin, another weight. It also means weighed. So we have numbered, we have weighed, and this would refer to Evil-Merodach, who is Nebuchadnezzar's son, who took over after Nebuchadnezzar died. And then the last word, parson, or eupharson, which means and parson, means divided. Okay, divided. Or parson also is the plural form of the word Perez. Okay. And Perez means divided, so it's multiply divided. And it would also refer to a half shekel or a divided shekel. Okay, and it symbolized a divided kingdom, right? Nabonidus and Belshazzar had split the kingdom, had co-ruled the kingdom. And by the way, parson also sounds like Persia, which is something that we're going to see very soon. So, what did all that mean? Verse 26, this is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered. Remember, Mene means numbered. God has numbered the days of your reign, Belshazzar, and brought it to an end. Okay? Your reign has finished. It's been numbered. Tekel, which means weighed, right? You have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided. and given to the Medes and Persians. Okay, so your days are numbered. You've been found to be underweight. You don't measure up. And your kingdom is now divided. And it will be given to the Persians. That's what all that meant. Well, how long did he have to wait before this happened? Verse 29. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he is proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom, just as Belshazzar said would happen, even though Daniel didn't want that. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. So how long did he have to wait? He didn't. Okay, his days were numbered. He was in his last day. He was underweight, and his kingdom was divided right then and there. And Darius Syaxerxes II took over. Okay, the name Darius means Lord King. That's kind of like the name Caesar or Pharaoh. It's a term used like that. So there's, you'll see a number of Dariuses referred to. It's just like saying, this one here was Darius Syaxerxes II. So it's like saying King Syaxerxes II. And from archaeological records, we've found stories that say what happened here. We found that the Persian army conquered Babylon in 539 BC. And if you look back, Judah was exiled through other records we see in 608 BC. Well, guess what? We're right at 70 years here, right? We'll talk more about that next week, or in a couple of weeks. The story that we found is that soldiers, the Persian soldiers, how do you break into Babylon? That was to take the nation of Babylon. You had to conquer Babylon. And how do you do that? We saw last week that the walls of Babylon were 86 feet thick. They were, in places, they were 300 feet tall, a football field tall. Their gates, they had six gates, but these were heavily, heavily fortified gates. There was no way to get in. Well, right through the middle of Babylon went the Euphrates River, right? And it was, Babylon was built on both sides of the Euphrates River. The Persians, upstream, they diverted the river. They dug a channel and they diverted the river, and that dried up and made a dry riverbed that they were able to walk under the walls of Babylon on this dry riverbed. They were led into the city by a couple of traders during the annual Feast of the Gods, is what the archaeological records tell us. Exactly what we're seeing here. This was the annual Feast of the Gods that Belshazzar was celebrating here. Okay? Alright, so now the Persians are in control. The Babylonian kingdom has come to an end. We saw last week that it lasted for 86 years, and now we've seen the end of it. So Darius takes control, the Persians and the Medes, and how does he organize his kingdom? Chapter 6. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. So rather than trying to control everything, he set up a structure with 120 satraps that reported, and instead of reporting to him, he happened to control 120 guys, they reported to three head administrators, one of which was Daniel. Now Daniel, by this time, if you look at the years, was probably, well, was over 80 years old. Okay? So he was well along in years. As you would imagine, God blessed his work, just as he's blessed everything that we've seen him do with Daniel. Verse 3. Now Daniel was so distinguished, and so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities, that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Okay, because this king Darius was 62 years old when he took over, so he had a big nation, he had a big kingdom, and so he really was impressed with Daniel, so he was going to put him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him, because he was trustworthy, and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, we will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it's got something to do with the law of his God. So these people were so jealous of Daniel that they tried to find some way to discredit him, some way to get rid of him, but they couldn't find any way. He was very trustworthy. He was very diligent in his job, did a great job. They tried to dig up some dirt. They couldn't. They said the only way we're going to find anything against him is if it has something to do with his God, because he's very faithful to his God. That's the one thing that we can hang our head on. So what plan did they come up with? Well, verse 6. So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce a decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it into writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. So they knew that the only way to get to Daniel was to do something to pit him with his God against Darius. So they had this plan. They went to the king and said, King, you are the greatest. We want to dedicate this next month to you. So let's issue a decree, and a decree that cannot be changed, because remember we talked about that last week, that under the Persians, the king could issue any kind of command that he wanted, but once he issued it, he could not change it. It stood. Not even he could change it. So issue this decree that no one can worship anybody or anything except for you for the next month, because you're so great, king. And so that kind of gave him a big head, and he said, hey, that sounds pretty good. So he did that, and he set that decree out. Well, did Daniel obey this new law, or did he keep praying to Yahweh? Verse 10. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, what did he do? He went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to Yahweh just as he had done before. So you see that he remained faithful. Even though that decree there said that he would be thrown into a lion's den if he prayed to anything or anybody or any god other than King Darius, he did it. He remained faithful to Yahweh and prayed three times a day as was his custom. Well, he did this at home in his own bedroom. Did he ever get caught going on? Verse 11, then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days anyone who prays to any god or man except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. Well, then they said to the king, well, Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree that you put in writing. He still prays to his God three times a day. So they caught him, and rather than just bringing him to Darius, they had to remind Darius of his decree, and that the decree could not be changed, and Darius agreed with that. And he said, oh, by the way, Daniel is guilty of breaking your decree. And they reported Daniel's crime. Well, how did Darius respond to Daniel's blatant disregard for this law? When the king heard this, verse 14, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. We've seen what he thinks of Daniel. He thinks very, very highly of Daniel, so much so that he's planning to make Daniel in charge of the whole nation, of the whole kingdom. And now he recognizes that this decree that he was tricked into putting into effect has backfired, and now he must throw Daniel into the lion's den. He's greatly distressed. And he makes every effort till sundown, checking the laws, trying to find some loophole, some way that he could free Daniel and not have to throw Daniel into his death in the lion's den. Well, why didn't he just cancel this stupid decree? The men went to the group, verse 15, went as a group to the king and said to him, remember, O king, that according to the laws of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. See? They're rubbing it in. They're pushing it in. They're saying it's against the law to change a decree, even by the king. And you see that in next week's lesson. We're going to look at the story in the book of Esther. And you see in Esther 1 verse 19 and 8 verse 8 the same thing, because that's during the reign of the Persians. And once a decree is issued, not even the king can change it. And Darius knows that. Well, was Darius able to find any way to save Daniel? Going on. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den so that Daniel couldn't get out. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. So there was nothing he could do. There was no way out of it. There was no way to stop from throwing Daniel into the lion's den. The only hope now was Daniel's God, that Daniel's God would rescue him. And so he says, Daniel, may your God rescue you. Well, he throws him in the lion's den, and he has to leave him in there. So how well does he sleep that night? Going on. The king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him. And he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? So he's hoping, he's praying that Daniel's still there, that God, Daniel's God, had saved him. So what had happened? Going on, Daniel answered, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and he shut the mouths of the lions. They've not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done anything wrong before you, O king. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. So we see that God protected Daniel all night, all through the night, from these lions. Well, maybe the lions just weren't hungry, right? You know, maybe that was why. Verse 24. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. So no, the lions were very hungry. Darius had the men who had accused Daniel thrown in and their families, and they were eaten before they fell to the end of the den. Okay. Well, what's the purpose of this story? What's the purpose of any of the stories that we have? That God's name be glorified, right? Well, was God's name glorified through this story? Going on. Then King Darius wrote to the peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, may you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered through the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So Darius sent a decree throughout the world praising God, just as we had seen Nebuchadnezzar had done. So God intervened with these pagan kings, and they recognized God. Yahweh is God. Yahweh is sovereign. God as king of all, ruler of all. And there's our stories in Daniel. Now in the next chapters, chapter 7 through the end of the book in chapter 12, we have more ways of how Daniel was blessed. Okay, Daniel's along in lines in life. Now it goes backwards in time now. Okay? In chapter 7, you see in verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. So it's gone back in time, because now, the second half of the book of Daniel, we see some visions. And God blesses Daniel with four visions of the future. And they happen at four different times. And so it goes back in time to start them, and it happens chronologically. Chapter 7, we have this first one. And you have this story of these four beasts. Okay? And in verse 16, Daniel says, I approached one of those standing there and asked him the true meaning of all this, of this vision of these beasts. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things and said, the four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth, but the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. And goes on then to explain what the beasts are. And basically this vision that you have in chapter 2 is just like, and the meaning of it is just like in the same meaning as we have of the vision of Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue in chapter 2. Okay, so we have these four world powers, and we saw that to be the Babylonians and the Persians and then the Greeks and then the Romans. But then there was this great rock, if you remember, Nebuchadnezzar's, and also what you see here, this kingdom that will last forever. That's the kingdom of Jesus Christ that comes during the time of that last kingdom. So chapter 7 is a vision that Daniel had years after Nebuchadnezzar's dream. This is while Belshazzar was king, the first year of Belshazzar's kingship. And he has a vision that reinforces that story of what's going to happen. Chapter 8, we see verse 1, in the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had another vision after the one that had already appeared to me. And he goes on and tells that vision of a goat and a ram and all this kind of stuff. So in chapter 8, there's another vision, and that vision is interpreted for Daniel, and it talks about future world powers and how they would be destroyed by God, because God's in control of all this. Then in chapter 9, well, we see verse 1, in the first year of Darius, the son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom, okay, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, etc. And we see another vision. And this vision here, let's see, verse 21 says, while I was speaking and praying, in verse 20, confessing my sin and the sin of my people, Israel, and making my request to Yahweh my God for his holy hill, while I was still in prayer, Gabriel, the man I had seen in an earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice, and then he revealed this vision and meaning of the vision. And what we have here are times that are talked about for the coming of the Messiah. You really see that in verse 25. It says, no one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off. So it gives the time for when the Messiah is going to come. And we'll talk about this in a few weeks, that time is exactly it. These sevens are 7 years. So seven sevens is 49 years, and then there's 62 sevens, and if you add all that up, you got 77, so 490 years from the time of this vision to the coming of Jesus. And you know what? It's exactly that. And we'll talk about that in a few weeks. So you have that vision in chapter 9. Then in chapter 10, as well as chapters 11 and 12, you've got a fourth vision that God gives him. You see in verse 1 of chapter 10, this happens in the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia. A revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. The understanding of the message that came to him in a vision. And it goes on to tell us the vision and the meaning, and it has to do with the future of Israel, as well as what would happen in the end times, what would happen in the time of the coming of the Messiah and the second coming. And so you can read through those if you'd like, but God blesses Daniel. Daniel is a man highly favored, it talks about, and that's what we see. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we give you thanks for the great stories of great people who preceded us. We thank you for the praise, the faith, the righteousness of Daniel, and the way that you worked through him and through his life. Help us to continue to look to him and others, other people of faith as examples, so that we may model the faith that they emulate for us in the relationship they had with you. Work your spirit in our lives so that we may see your will for our lives as Daniel saw his will, was not afraid to stand up against the kings, and continued to worship you. In Christ's name, amen.